Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Little kids are usually super excited to get on planes, while the rest of us shuffle in and complain about those small overhead bins or those terrible seats. Kids are like, whoa, this is amazing. Jennifer Eberhard's son was no exception.
He was just really excited about being on this airplane with mommy. And we got on the plane and he's like looking all around and he's checking things out. He's checking people out.
He was 5 at the time, just taking it all in.
And he sees this man and he looks at him and he says, "Hey, that guy looks like daddy." So I look at the man and he doesn't look anything at all like my husband. So I start to look around on the plane myself and I notice that this man is the only black man on the plane. And I thought, all right, you know, I'm going to have a little talk with my son about how not all black people look alike.
But before she did that, she thought, wait a minute, maybe there is some resemblance after all, something I'm missing.
And I look at his height, nothing there, his weight, nothing, skin color, no resemblance. And then I look at his hair, and this man has long dreadlocks flowing down his back. And my husband shaves his head. And so I thought, okay, you know, I'm going to have this talk with my son. But before I could say anything to him, he looks up at me and he says, "I hope he doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "What? What did you say?" And he said it again. He says, "Well, I hope that man doesn't rob the plane." And I said, "Well, you know, why would you say that? You know, daddy wouldn't rob a plane." And he said, yeah, I know." And I said, "Well, why would you say that?" And he looked at me with this really sad face, and he said, "I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I was thinking that." You know, this, you know, we're living with such severe racial stratification that this association between blackness and crime, you know, made its way into the mind of my 5-year-old. And it makes its way into the minds of all of our children and to all of us.
Jennifer is a social psychologist at Stanford University, and her main focus is implicit bias.
Implicit bias can be defined as the beliefs and feelings we have about social groups that can influence our decision-making and our actions, even when we're not aware of it, even when it's your intention to be fair.
So it's a lens of sorts with which I see people, even if I don't realize the lens is there.
That's correct.
The term implicit bias was first coined in 1995 by psychologists Tony Greenwald and Mazarin Banaji. Mazarin told me she uses the analogy of a blind spot.
Just as our eyes have a blind spot where information can't be detected, we believe that our brains have several of these blind spots that have to do with our inability to be able to accurately ascertain the cause of something or to figure out why somebody's doing what they're doing. And we use our stereotypes about different groups to fill in the blanks.
This is different from overt racism because it's unintentional. It happens without us even noticing. But implicit bias can be harmful and dangerous. It can mean the job opportunity a person didn't get, the patient who's treated differently by a doctor or nurse, the customer who is accused of stealing, the grad student being told they are in the wrong room, the driver being pulled over for no reason. And these biases can lead to violence, somebody getting killed by police because the officer assumed this person was armed and dangerous. As we're trying to have more serious conversations about racism in this country, we're also hearing more about implicit bias, that we all have work to do in understanding and changing our behaviors and attitudes. On this episode, we explore implicit bias. What is it? How can we test for it? And what can we do about it? Let's hear more of my conversation with psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt. Her book is called Biased, Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. One of the main things she studies is the psychological association between race and crime. So she just told me about her son, who was 5 at the time, and he wondered out loud if a black man seated near them was going to rob their plane. And these were messages that he soaked up somehow from the outside, obviously, from what he saw on television, from what he was hearing.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, he did soak, you know, that message up, I think, in a variety of ways. But I feel like we're too quick, you know, to point to the media, you know, as the culprit here, because I feel like there's a lot that we do in our everyday interactions that can lead to that message, right? So I have another son who, when he was a first grader, he was asking me if I thought people thought about black people in a different kind of way than white people. And I was asking him what he meant by it. And he said he didn't know, but he just felt like there was something different, like that black people were perceived in a different kind of way. And when I asked him to give me an example, you know, he gave me an example of us being at the grocery store a couple days before, and there was a black man who walked in. Now, we were in a neighborhood that was a mostly white neighborhood, and when the black man walks in, my son noticed that, you know, people kind of stayed away from him a little bit, he said. Like, it was like a giant force field around him, so he was really into Star Wars then, and so he was using that language, and he was talking about how people kind of stayed away, and when the man got in the line to check out, right, that his was the shortest line for the longest time because people didn't want to get behind him. And when I asked him, well, what does that all mean? What do you think it means? And he thought, and he said, I don't know initially. And then he thought about it more, and he looked at me, and he says, I think it's fear. You know, it's just, so this is a first grader, right, coming to that conclusion. And it wasn't from watching television or cartoons. It was from watching us. It was from watching how we move through the world and picking up on signs, you know, and understanding sort of what's correlated with what.
That's psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt. We're talking about implicit bias. It's a lens that shapes our view of the world and of other people without us being aware of it. On a deeper level, where does this come from? Why did our brains evolve in this way? I reached out to Corey Cook. He is an evolutionary psychologist.
And typically, when we view some phenomenon, some behavior that we're very interested in, we take a step back and say, okay, why might this behavior have developed over time? Is there a possibility that this behavior or this pattern served some evolutionary purpose?
Mainly survival and procreation.
You know, we lived for hundreds of thousands of years in small, close-knit, interdependent groups, and we developed very robust and common behavioral tendencies to be able to maximize our chances of survival within those groups and chances of the groups kind of being successful in competition with others.
Now, if we want to apply this lens of evolutionary psychology to the idea, the concept of implicit bias, what could be at the root of implicit bias? What function might it have served at some point in time?
It's a self-protective mechanism. And unfortunately, our brains really are hardwired to recognize kind of threats and opportunities in our environment. And threats weigh heavier than opportunities because the cost of a threat can often outweigh a potential opportunity when that cost is you know, your own life or your own safety or the safety of your loved ones. And so we're cognitively attuned to pick up on cues to threat. And I think that implicit biases often serve a similar function. So, you know, if you've grown up in U.S. culture, or even just lived in U.S. culture, you start to pick up implicitly the stereotypes of different groups. And if those stereotypes are related to threat-related information, then implicitly you don't have to necessarily believe it for it to hit you, to resonate, that you start to associate certain groups or certain members of groups with threat-related information. And so I think that what happens, unfortunately, in U.S. society, for instance, is something like skin color becomes a cue to threat.
Now, in some of your studies on implicit bias, you checked into something that is called belief in a dangerous world. What does that mean?
Belief in a dangerous world is really the extent to which an individual perceives other people as dangerous and kind of out to get mine. I use in my family, like my grandma, as an example. When I was growing up and I had new friends, she'd always think, well, what do they want from me? And I think we all have that hypervigilant person that we know. Some people who have high belief in a dangerous world really are kind of prone to not trusting other people. And they do. They're more likely to perceive other people as dangerous. And in my research, what we found is that simply mentioning something about crime being on the rise, for instance, elicits a fear-based response in people who are higher in belief in a dangerous world, where they start to show greater prejudices toward groups that are simply stereotyped as being criminals. So in my study in particular, people with higher belief in a dangerous world, after reading a news story about crime being on the rise, showed greater prejudice toward immigrants and greater prejudice toward Muslims.
So as I've been thinking about this, I've been thinking about our brains sort things into different categories all day long, right? And that's sort of when you watch babies and toddlers, that's one of the first things that's amazing to watch them do, is how they recognize, oh, this is a dog, and this is also a dog, and this is a dog, and this too is a dog, even though they all look different, right? So that's something we do all day long. We sort stuff into categories. And I'm wondering what your take is on how this implicit bias ties into our automatic sorting of things that are alike or not alike.
Our brains are phenomenally complex. The most complex organic thing we might know of on the planet, and also in a lot of ways phenomenally simple. Its task is to make sense of our environment, at least at the level of perception. We have a tendency to want things to fit into categories, and we over-categorize. And you mentioned infants. For instance, an infant has very basic rules of categorization. If they see four legs and a tail and looks friendly, it might be a dog. And so the first time they see a horse, they might categorize a horse as a dog. And we call that bottom-up learning. So when you're first encountering the world around you, you really are learning bottom-up, where you're creating those categories that will serve you for the rest of your life. And after, you know, decades of living and learning and becoming adults, you really interpret the world around you much more top down, where you already have your categories. You already have what we would call schemas about the world around you. And now, instead of seeing something and trying to figure out where it best fits within the knowledge you have, you instead take the knowledge you have and say, okay, what does this most look like? And so we tend to over-apply our stereotypes or our schemas to make sense of the world around us once we've have those categories set. And unfortunately, sometimes those categories are set very strongly, and it's very difficult to really reverse and take that bottom-up look and see something from a new, fresh perspective.
That's evolutionary psychologist Corey Cook from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about implicit bias, ideas or prejudice that we have about other people that we're not aware of, but that affect our decisions and actions. How do you make these hidden biases visible? How do you measure them? There is a test you can take. It's called the Implicit Association Test. It's online, and there's a bunch of different versions: age, gender, disabilities, race. So basically, you look at a bunch of different pictures or terms, and then you have to hit keys on your keyboard as fast as you can to say this term or picture is associated with this word. Woman, female. Husband, male. Girl, female. Father, male. Aunt, female. Harvard psychologist Mazarin Banaji is one of the researchers who developed this test. And she says, don't be surprised if your results show that you have a bias toward a certain group.
When I took the race test, which was the first test I took, my first response was, the test is screwed up. There's something about this test that's wrong. That's how deeply skeptical I was about a test invented in my own science using methods I was extremely familiar with. And then a few seconds later, when I tried the test in a variety of different ways and my score wouldn't budge, that's when I realized it's not the test that's screwed up, it's my head that's screwed up. And it's because I carry the thumbprint of the culture on my brain, and I had better become aware of that.
A few years ago, Ted Johnson, an African-American writer and scholar on race, decided to take the version of the test that measures racial biases. The results were not what he expected. Liz Tung has more.
If you go all the way back, Ted Johnson's interest in the implicit association test started with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin.
Trayvon Martin's death was sort of an inflection point for me.
This was in 2012. It seemed like the whole country was arguing about what happened to 17-year-old Trayvon and whose fault it was.
You know, it seemed pretty clear to me that he was a innocent young black man walking home from the store and was confronted by this neighborhood vigilante, and things went horribly afterwards, and Trayvon ends up dead.
How could people see the same situation in such different ways? Over the next couple years, Ted, who was a PhD student at the time, started digging into the question of how race affects our perceptions of reality.
And chasing that question sort of led me to this implicit association test.
Ted was taking the version of the test that measures bias for and against black and white people.
Going into the test, I thought that it would reveal that I had no bias one way or another, either for or against black people, or frankly, for or against white people.
So Ted takes the test, and then he hits submit.
I had essentially a bias against black people.
The news hit Ted like a sucker punch to the gut.
Sitting with those results, you know, for a while, I started to wonder what was it about maybe my life or my views, my education, that would elicit such a response.
Ted grew up in an affluent, mostly white suburb, which meant as a kid, most of the black people in his life were people he was close to. His family, his church. Those were the people who shaped Ted's idea of what being black meant. So how could it be that he had a bias against them? But then Ted had another thought. What about black strangers?
The story that came to mind immediately was, I think it was Jesse Jackson talking about walking in a parking garage and being worried if there was a, you know, young black man behind him.
It occurred to Ted that maybe he had more than one idea about blackness. The idea formed by his friends and family, and another idea based on ugly stereotypes that until now Ted had never thought he bought into, but which, according to the test, had taken up camp in his mind.
It became pretty clear to me along the way that I had sort of become a medium for views society has of black people, and that sort of I processed them and spit them out on this test. And so I didn't know so much that it was a reflection of my personal views as it was a reflection of society and sort of how society views folks that look like me.
It was an uncomfortable thought, but also it occurred to Ted, one he and a lot of people needed to have. Because if you can't see your own biases, then, well, you can't see your own biases. If you see a young black man and immediately think that he's dangerous without acknowledging the forces that might lead you to think that, you assume you must be right, that it must be something about him that's off or wrong or bad. You become blind to the bigger forces that are creating a racist reality.
If we were really going to ever overcome racism, then we have to acknowledge all of the ways it infects our society, and we can't make this a thing about what white people do to black people, but think about it in terms of the way the nation permits structures that foster racist outcomes to persist and approach the problem by trying to dismantle those structures instead of thinking of racism as a journey of converting people's hearts one by one. And I think the danger of not recognizing the way racism affects all of us in a society is that you turn away from the structures that cause it and turn towards another group of people that then become sort of like the antagonist for your group.
But alongside all this high-level philosophizing, Ted had another, more gut reaction to his test results.
Maybe this was an aberration. Maybe this was a mistake. Let me take the test again.
So he did. But this time, he went in prepared. Over the 7 parts of the test, he wrestled with his own response times. And then he hit submit.
And it revealed I had less bias than the first test suggested.
Not quite what Ted was looking for, but it felt like a victory nonetheless. Now, if you're wondering whether Ted cheated, whether he intentionally manipulated his responses, the answer is yes. But as Ted discovered with a bit of research, that's actually okay.
As I dug around more following that second test, I started to see results that suggested you could train yourself out of that bias once you're consciously aware that the bias exists.
In fact, it seemed like that's exactly what Ted was doing with each additional test, gauging his biases and fighting against them the next time around. Still, Ted had no illusions about what it all meant.
Taking the test again and again and scoring lower on the anti-Black bias doesn't mean that suddenly you've become less racist or less susceptible to racism in society. It just means that you've now trained yourself to be aware of that bias.
The question is, do those changes matter? Does a half second's difference in how we react to a white face versus a Black face actually mean anything in the real world? If yes, Ted, the answer is yes.
I mean, if we look at the case of Tamir Rice in Cleveland, it only took a snap second for the officer to step out of the car and see this 12-year-old Black boy with a toy gun and sense threat. 2 seconds of consideration may have saved his life.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. The implicit association test has become a widely used and influential tool, but does it truly work?
In the academic sphere, there is a lot of debate over implicit bias and, you know, the validity of the test.
That's Olivia Goldhill. She is a science reporter for the global online news site Quartz. She started investigating the test in 2017, and she got some pushback.
I think some people were worried that because I was questioning the science of this test, I was questioning, you know, is there racism? And I'm definitely not doing that. If anything, I'm saying, you know, are we more consciously racist than we would like to believe? And implicit bias has become an excuse.
In her reporting, Olivia says she found some issues with the test. Well, let's say I take the IAT, and let's say I come out to be slightly biased, you know, in favor of white people. Does that mean I act on that? Or does that just mean it's something that is inside of my brain, but I manage to override it most of the time?
This is one of the biggest criticisms with the IAT, that the studies show that there's no correlation between your result and behavior.
Another thing that Olivia found with the test is that the results vary a lot. Ted Johnson, who we just heard from, took the test a few times with changing results, and he saw this ultimately as a positive thing, but Olivia says from a science perspective, that's a problem.
So yeah, that is a concern, that the test isn't up to standard. So a lot of tests will have a practice effect. So what scientists will do is they'll give someone a test a couple of times and the first couple of scores will vary. And then they get to kind of a level of being comfortable, and then the test and the reliability should be pretty high. But that doesn't happen with the IAT. It just seems to vary a lot no matter how much practice someone has had.
Even with some of this criticism, Olivia still thinks the test is an important tool. For example, to get people thinking about biases and racism in a way that doesn't make them immediately defensive.
You know, a lot of people are very resistant to the idea that racism and prejudice still exists and that they could play a role in it. And I think that the IAT and implicit bias in some ways quite a kind of gentle way to challenge those views.
Olivia Goldhill is a science reporter for the news site Quartz. Coming up, finding ways to attack and diminish our biases.
We can slow down. We can ask ourselves the right questions.
That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about implicit bias. So far, we've covered where it comes from and how we can test for it. So now the big question is, what can you actually do about it? I asked psychologist Mazarin Banaji. She developed the implicit bias test.
I think taking the test is important. I think knowing where you stand, roughly speaking, is important. Once you know that you have the bias, I think you have to be on a journey because this is not a one-moment fix. The good thing about these biases is that you don't need to spend huge amounts of money to fix it or do it in one big swoop. You just need to do it in little bits every single day. Think about it very much like exercising. And one of the first things to do is to be skeptical of your own choices. When I look at two candidates for a job, and I have to pick one, and I love one, and I don't love the other so much, I have to ask myself, why? Do I like this one because she and I went to the same high school? Or do I like this one because she looks like me? I think we will, first of all, begin to shape our own behaviors. And human beings are wonderful at this, right? We have come to become such different people over these several millennia that I have great optimism that when we understand that we will change our behavior.
Many companies and universities have conducted training sessions for years to create awareness or to offer strategies to move beyond these harmful assumptions. But it's not always a favorite activity among employees.
When you hear you have to do these online trainings, it's like, oh God, you know, you hear the heavy sighs, I have to do this, HR is after me to do this training. So that's the first problem, is people feel like they have to do it.
Unfortunately, I felt that it wasn't as effective as it could be because it was a lot of talking. It was very much a feeling of someone coming in, talking at you, and then leaving.
What's the experience like for the people conducting the trainings? And what do they think in terms of how valuable this is? Alan Yu reports.
Andrea Lawful-Sanders runs implicit bias training around the country. One time she was working with a police district. She shadowed an officer for 6 hours. The officer is white, Andrea is black Jamaican. At the end of the day, he admitted something to her.
The gentleman that I was driving with this particular day said to me, when you first came to us and you said that both your children graduated from college and that they had never been in trouble, he said, I looked at you and said, this can't be true because I don't know any people of color that are successful and doing well without somebody giving them a leg up.
She says she was actually encouraged by what he said because it meant he was thinking through what he learned and trusted her enough to be vulnerable. The officers liked her training so much, they asked their superintendent when she was coming back. Evelyn Carter is a social psychologist and director of training at the diversity and inclusion consulting company Paradigm. One time she was talking to a room of mostly white people about the health impacts of microaggressions, subtle signals and slights.
And I remember locking eyes with a black woman who was in my training and there were tears streaming down her face and she was nodding. And I feel very deeply a sense of responsibility when I am leading these trainings that we're not just talking about abstract concepts like bias, right? It's not just this thing that happens out in the world. It has a real impact on people.
Sometimes people do not want this training.
Wherever we go, many in that group are somewhere between defensive and outright hostile.
Lori Friedel is a criminologist at the University of South Florida. She works on a team that trains police departments around the country.
They know they're going to fair and impartial policing training, and they think that we're going to stand in the front of the room and treat them all like racists.
She says their team gets around that by saying the training is on human bias, not police bias. Also, all their trainers are retired or current police officers. So the officers getting trained can't dismiss it as some academic parachuting in for a day.
This training is not going to cure a racist cop of animus towards minority groups, but it will inform the police officer of good intentions that every officer is a part of the problem of bias policing and a significant part of the solution.
Right now, many organizations and companies say they want to create equitable and fair working environments. They offer implicit bias training as a solution. Calvin Lai is a psychologist at Washington University in St. Louis and an expert on implicit bias. He has been getting a lot of inquiries lately.
We have a research website where people can learn about implicit bias, and our traffic has just been through the roof. Every day I get different requests from students, ex-students, members of the public, and various organizations.
Employers are eager to do something, but does training lead to change?
If the goal is training to eliminate implicit biases, there's no evidence that that training works.
Tony Greenwald is a psychologist at the University of Washington. He is one of the researchers who helped coin the term implicit bias and developed the implicit association test. He says the training offers education. People can learn what implicit bias is and where it comes from.
Those are enjoyable and educational, but by themselves, they don't solve the problem.
He says real change goes beyond the training. It requires structural changes. For example, implicit biases often come into play when people have to make quick decisions. Tony and Calvin Lai recently reviewed implicit bias research and found that's one of the areas that needs to be addressed. Here's Calvin.
And so a lot of the strategies revolve around how to give yourself more time to think and how to kind of put guardrails on how you judge other people so that you're less likely to act on your biases.
Andrea Lawful Sanders agrees. She's the trainer we heard from earlier. She says for these trainings to have lasting impact, the commitment has to go beyond attending a few sessions.
This work is too intentional, it is too precious, and it is too tenuous for you to say, well, I'm going to train you for half a day, and that's the end of that. Mm-mm. And every time someone calls me and says that's what they want to tell them, then you have the wrong trainer, because I can't handle it. You are wasting your time, my time, and your money.
She works with companies and organizations for years, and the process includes policy and culture changes. Say it's a school district. Andrea asks the administrators to pull out all their policies on race and bullying. Sometimes they don't have any. She makes it clear that organizations have to examine every part of their culture. Paradigm, the diversity and inclusion company, actually started out not doing implicit bias training, but doing that kind of work on systems and structures. Here's co-founder and CEO Joel Emerson.
I was really motivated by the idea that change in organizations has to be systemic. That's things like hiring processes, promotion practices, performance management processes.
For example, one way to reduce bias in job interviews is to have structure, writing specific questions that address the job for all candidates, and asking the people who are deciding whom to hire to justify why they think one person is better, rather than going by intuition to avoid just picking people like themselves. But companies have to explain these processes. Their employees have to understand why they are doing this.
Maybe you have a form that you build and it's really thoughtfully designed and it's prompting interviewers to give reasons for their decisions about a candidate. Well, if an interviewer doesn't know why they're being asked to use that form and they just think it's an extra you know, bureaucratic step or a formality and they don't use it, it's not going to have the impact we want.
Evelyn, the social psychologist and training director at Paradigm, says there was this one company that did the training, changed their recruitment process. But when it came to their take-home hiring exam, the people who came through were still almost all men.
What they realized is that every single person who had contributed to creating the take-home exam was a man. Now, I'm not saying that men cannot create a good take-home exam. But what I am saying is that for this organization, what they realized is that they had narrowed the input of who was creating these processes to such a homogenous group that it makes sense that the output was that only homogenous groups of people were the ones who were making it to the other end of that stage.
Right now, companies are interested in diversity, equity, and inclusion. Calvin Lai says there is hope that this isn't just a passing fad.
Is useful to think about this in terms of years and decades rather than something that will change overnight. Some of these inequalities are so deeply embedded in the fabric of our society when it comes to things like generational inequalities and things like income and wealth that there's no way that they can be done overnight. But at the same time, I think that there can be periods where there is dramatic change. And I think we're living in one of those periods right now where there have been a sea rise in increases in support for Black Lives Matter, in support for political changes in beliefs in systemic racism and so on, that we haven't seen in prior political moments like this one.
That story was reported by Alan Yu. What changes or impacts these automatic responses and shortcuts in the brain? Neuroscientists Roy Hamilton and Anjan Chatterjee created an app as part of their research. One version of this app targeted biases people have toward others with facial abnormalities, like skin cancers, burns, scars, or a cleft palate. Here's Anjan.
People with typical faces have implicit biases against individuals that have these sorts of anomalies. What that means is they think that such individuals are less trustworthy, less honest, less intelligent, less competent, and so on, and often don't even realize that they have these associations.
Anjan says Hollywood and popular media reinforce those stereotypes. Think the murderous Freddy Krueger or Scar in Lion King.
And you shall never see the light of another day.
So Anjan wondered if a smartphone app could change people's automatic responses. There were 100 people in this study.
People would come into the lab. They do the implicit association test. So we have a baseline of their implicit bias. Then they go home with this app. They're pinged twice a day. And when they're pinged, they open up the app. They see a series of faces. After that, they are given one of those faces and they're told a little vignette about the person. Like so-and-so is driving along the highway, they see someone with a flat tire, they pull over to see if they can help. And after that, they're asked a question if they can, the extent to which they could see themselves being in that role. That's what they do twice a day for 5 days, and then they come back into the lab and then repeat the implicit association test. So we're interested in what changed.
And here's the thing. Anjan tested this app in two different ways. With one group of participants, he tried to change their bias toward those with facial abnormalities. With another group, he targeted racial bias and showed them faces of people of color.
Everybody's scores on the implicit bias as a group tends to diminish the second time, but it's specifically the intervention with the facial anomalies where we see a specific decrease of the bias in a way that we do not with people of color.
I was initially fairly surprised with the findings. Implicit biases, you know, these automatic perceptions, understandings and behaviors that we have learned can be very difficult to manipulate, to move.
That's neuroscientist Roy Hamilton, who worked with Anjan on this study.
It was not as remarkable to me, at least, that it didn't have as much of a notable impact on implicit biases about racial identity. Insofar as I think that there are multifactorial and in many cases deeply held notions of race that go well beyond the differences that accrue with appearance. Be it as it may, I think it's really important to come up with interventions that can move the needle on implicit biases. And just the idea that we could do so in one domain is, in my opinion, really encouraging.
Roy Hamilton and Anjan Chatterjee are both researchers and professors of neurology at the University of Pennsylvania. Earlier on, we heard from social psychologist Jennifer Eberhardt. She also has looked into technology and how it affects or interacts with our biases. For example, she worked on the app Nextdoor. It's a social media platform where neighbors can advertise a garage sale or complain about things like dog poop or post safety concerns.
And they discovered they had a problem with racial profiling on the platform. I mean, a lot of people have used Nextdoor and have seen people sort of make posts about suspicious activity or suspicious people and so forth. And they realized that when people did this, sometimes they were profiling, right? So someone would look outside their window and they would see a black man in an otherwise white neighborhood, and they would report that man as suspicious, even when there's no evidence of any criminal wrongdoing. And so, you know, the co-founder of Nextdoor reached out to me and reached out to others to try to figure out what could they do. And they realized, they discovered, right, that they were going to need to slow people down and get them to challenge their intuitions. And so they did this by simply putting a checklist up. And so when people hit on the crime and safety tab, to report suspicious activity, a checklist would pop up. And the first item on that checklist was, you know, what was this person doing that made him suspicious, right? So your race simply isn't grounds for suspicion. And so many people have seen those signs in airports, if you see something, say something. So they were trying to modify this. It was, if you see something suspicious, say something specific. And they found, just using that technique, they were able to reduce profiling by over 75%. So 75% reduction.
Of just posting, I saw this guy and I don't know what he's doing, but I don't like it. So here it is, right?
Right, right. So you redirect what they're thinking, right? So it's not, you know, I don't know what he's doing. It's like, so what is he doing, right, that makes him suspicious? So all of those sort of techniques are techniques that they use to slow people down and redirect them. And we can apply these same principles, right, to our own lives. We can slow down. We can, you know, replace our intuition with intelligence, right? We can ask ourselves, you know, the right questions, right? We can hold ourselves accountable and so forth.
Much of Jennifer's research has involved the criminal justice system and police departments. In Oakland, California, she worked with police to reduce the number of stops they were making of people who weren't committing any serious crimes.
And we did this by just adding a simple question to the form that officers complete during a stop. And that question was, is this stop intelligence-led, yes or no? And what they mean by intelligence-led is, did I have prior information, right, to tie this specific person to a particular crime? You know, push them to use evidence of wrongdoing in place of intuition. Just using that technique, we were able to reduce the number of African-American stops by over 43%.
It sounds like time and taking a moment to rethink what you're doing is really important. But when we're talking about police officers shooting a person, there's often that pressure to do something right now. And I'm wondering what could help in that moment where maybe there isn't in the mind of the officer a millisecond to think this over.
Right. There, I think you have to think about what comes before that moment. What is the situation you're walking into where you're forced to make that split-second decision? Again, in Oakland, I can give you an example. They used to have a foot pursuit policy. I think many
police departments still have this kind of foot pursuit policy where you're, you know, chasing a suspect, for example, and they run, you know, down an alley and you lose track of them, you lose sight of them, or they run into an enclosed space, like a backyard or something, and, you know, you would just follow them in, right? So they changed the policy so that if you lost sight of a suspect, you couldn't continue their pursuit. You had to step back, you'd have to set up a perimeter, you'd have to sort of think through what your options were and so forth. And they found that, you know, just that simple thing of actually providing the space and providing the time, basically, to think it through, that they were able to reduce the number of officer-involved shootings they had.
By changing the conditions of a situation that can inspire bias, Jennifer says you can change the probability that a person would act on bias. More recently, Jennifer has been looking into police body camera footage, which is not routinely reviewed by officers or by civilians. But Jennifer says it's a treasure trove of data. Her team's been looking at this footage to discern certain behavior patterns, for example, during traffic stops.
And we're finding that even when officers are, you know, behaving professionally, they speak to Black drivers with less respect than white drivers. And so we are working together with an interdisciplinary team of researchers at Stanford to apply like a machine learning approach to this, to combing through the data and looking at the words that officers are using when they're, you know, stopping drivers. In fact, from the words that officers are using alone, we can predict whether they're talking to a Black driver or a white driver.
Wow. And when you present that data back to police officers or to police departments, what do they say? What's the reaction you get?
Well, there are different reactions. I think it's hard to argue with the data, right? Because it's the officer's own words, right? It's not our interpretation of it or anything, but it's just, you know, this is what was said, basically, right? And some of the differences, too, are subtle. So sometimes they don't, you know, always know that they're speaking to Black drivers differently than white drivers. Some differences are less subtle. So, for example, we found that when they greeted white drivers, they were more likely to, you know, say sir or, you know, mister or ma'am, use those, you know, kinds of titles. But with Black drivers, and only with Black drivers, they would say bro and dude and those kinds of things. So that was not so subtle. But even with that, you know, I think the reaction was, well, it's not like a sign of disrespect to use those titles. It's this, basically, you're using the language that people, you know, use. They're trying to actually be more relatable. And so it's almost like a sign of respect from their perspective that they're saying bro and dude and so forth. But the issue with that is that when we have people listen, you know, to that language, and we found that they didn't think bro and dude was respectful.
And one last quick question. Overall, do you feel optimistic and hopeful at this moment in time that we can get somewhere with this?
Yes, I mean, I definitely feel more optimistic now than I have in a long time. I feel as a country, we're focused on this issue now. I think there's a lot of power in reflection. There's a lot of learning going on now and a lot of will, I think, you know, to actually stay on this and to think about it. I think it's too soon to tell whether this will turn the tide in terms of real impact, but I'm definitely hopeful that it will.
That's psychologist Jennifer Eberhard. Her book is called Biased: Uncovering the Hidden Prejudice That Shapes What We See, Think, and Do. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, and this week we had engineering help from Al Banks and Mike Villers. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.